This Parlamerica's podcast is part of a series that explores how strategic collaboration across sectors, including between parliamentarians and civil society, can foster positive cultural and legislative change that contributes to eliminating gender inequality. Rose Marie Antoine is Dean of the Faculty of Law and Professor of Labor Law and Offshore Financial Law at the University of the West Indies, St. Augustine. In this presentation, Professor Antoine provides a comparative analysis of legislative measures that exist to address workplace sexual harassment and discusses important considerations when designing new laws and protections on this topic. This presentation was recorded during the inter-parliamentary meeting for Parlamerica's Anglophone membership, Partnerships to Transform Gender Relations, held in Kingston, Jamaica on January 24th and 25th, 2018.
Good morning to all of you very distinguished people. So I am going to be looking, of course, at the law, the nuts and bolts, the legal dimensions of sexual harassment. I know you've looked at all different angles yesterday. And of course, it's a topic that has been very much, I would say, hot press lately. Everywhere we turn, from movie stars to the church, it seems it's a topic of choice, but it is nothing new. As I think this kit really brought out, it's an issue of deep social significance, and as we like to say in law, from time immemorial. But it is one of those topics that has been invisibilized, or worse, trivialized. And now, of course, it's mushroomed, and from a personal viewpoint, just last week, Barbados passed its law. As you heard, I was in part of a group that lobbied for many years. So very gratifying, but yet still, I'm a bit disappointed in the scope of the law, but we would talk about that. It's still a step forward. Yesterday, too, it made sort of the indignation, which seems to be so sudden and outrage. A person received 175 years for sexual assault, which is more than some get for murder. So, but I still, the doctor in the gymnastics. But I do believe that there are still many persons out there who are a bit unsure of what to make of what seems to be this sudden explosion of sexual harassment complaints and scenarios. How much of what we're hearing in the media will have legal legs or concrete legal liabilities or consequences? So for me, two main questions are the compelling ones for us here to interrogate today. One would be, what exactly is sexual harassment? And the byproduct of that is, what is it not? And what are the limits, if any, of sexual harassment liability? And there's a third sort of sub-issue, which is, for us in the region, given that we are relatively undeveloped in relation to sexual harassment laws, which laws, if any, address sexual harassment here in the region? This is a very complex question, this topic. And one of the things we know is that the concept itself has witnessed a lot of deviation from when we first identified it. And one of the famous articles, Catherine MacKinnon, famous feminist, who wrote about naming and shaming the concept and the phenomenon. And so gave it a name, grounded it within the law. But what we have moved away from that original idea, so we still have to look at the inherent nature and substance. We know now it's not a narrow concept. And at first, and I suspect many of us know this already, we saw sexual harassment only in terms of sexual favors, what we call quid pro quo approach. But we know we've pushed the envelope quite a bit, and we know it's much more than that. Some of the more colorful understandings in our conscious, you remember singing Sandra, you could keep your money, I will keep my honey. So we tend to always identify sexual harassment. And of course, that is an important part of it. But it's more than that. So today, the universally accepted standard is the hostile working environment. And that concept of understanding, what makes an environment hostile? What makes conduct unacceptable and unwelcome? That, I think, in itself is a rich tapestry of social values, norms, attitudes that define us, unfortunately, not in positive ways. So sexual harassment is simply a symptom of a much deeper problem in our societies. And I think this Me Too movement, which is what they call the movie star, that's what they're calling it, Me Too, I think it has succeeded in broadening the discussion to the extent that we are looking at other angles today. Ultimately, it's about power. It's a question of power, an unequal power. Not just economic power. Very often we think about the boss, like even this kid, what the boss did or didn't do. That is a very important part of it. But when you think about what happens at the workplace and in other scenarios, what about a coworker? Does a coworker have that kind of economic power? No. So it can't only be about economic power. So I would suggest that really it's about unequal power between men and women, or even other genders, we probably wouldn't get there today. So that it's really this idea of power, the jurisprudence itself, the case law, has begun to verbalize. And once we understand that fundamental truth about sexual harassment, I think a lot of things fall into place. So we are thinking about fundamental inequality. And that elevates the concept, in my mind, to these broader, deeper values, which we start talking about human rights. We start talking about discrimination law. And I would say it's not so much what I say to a woman, and bear in mind I'm going to say woman a lot throughout this presentation. We know that it's not only women who harass, but typically it is women, but we do appreciate that it's not only women. So it's not only what I say, but why I say it. The attitudes, the assumptions, the stereotypes that underscore words and actions at the workplace and in the society at large. So therefore, I think the very recent question in the same Me Too movement about unequal pay or remuneration is part of that whole framework. And incidentally, for those of us in this room, the policymakers who don't believe it's a problem in the region, that is completely untrue. The reality, the statistics are quite staggering. Women in the Caribbean are still paid about twice less than men. For example, Trinidad and Tobago, the average income for a male is $18,000 and $9,000 for women. Some of it, of course, is due to what we call feminization of jobs. We don't have time to go into that. But these issues like unequal remuneration and unequal access to the job market and opportunities, I would suggest, both fuel and are the result of sexual harassment and its consequences. And initially, there was some resistance in the law, in the case law, the jurisprudence, and so on, to see sexual harassment as an aspect of gender discrimination or sex discrimination. But far and wide, the more recent cases, we moved away from these narrow prisms, and today we embrace it. If you look at the UK law, that notion of discrimination is written into it. If you look at the EU directive on human rights, they are written into it. And even more elevated planes of consciousness, for example, the South Africa Constitution talks about sexual harassment and talks about it in the context of equality and dignity. So that's what we're really talking about. So that's when we talk about hostile working environment. That is what we really mean. I think it is useful to try to determine, if we can, what sexual harassment is not. In most countries, it is, of course, a form of sexual violence. But usually it's not rape. It's not sexual assault. And I say that with a pinch of salt, because one or two countries, the same South Africa, they have defined sexual harassment to include rape and assault. But generally, that's not the formula. Usually in our systems, especially common law, UK, Europe, and so on, rape is something separate under the criminal law. And in fact, sometimes sexual harassment doesn't even come under the criminal law. So it's not that. And it seems pretty obvious that it is conduct and so based on sex. But even that can be a bit controversial and quite broad, not as simple as we think. So it's based on sex, sexual harassment, but to take a few not so obvious examples. So I think we all know if you try to sweet talk someone, I don't know, do we still say sweet talk? I don't know, am I showing my age? If you try to sweet talk somebody looking sexy and thing, we know that is sexual harassment. How about if you insulted somebody on the basis of, you know, if you say, boy, you could never get a man. Sorry to be a bit crude, but that's what we're talking about here. Is that sexual harassment? Some people are saying no. How about if we call a woman a mule? Do we know what a mule is? The older heads would know. A mule, the younger heads know too. A mule in the Caribbean is a woman who cannot have children. Now, in my mother's day, that was the worst insult you could ever give a woman, right? So if someone is at work and you keep saying, you're an old mule, blah, 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 is that sexual harassment? Ah, yeah, yay. See, it's kind of hard. Ah, yes. If you say it's based on sex or gender, can a man be a mule? Ah. So you see where we start to really think, of course we could define our legislation and our law in more narrow ways. And one of the disappointments I have about the Barbados Act is that it's been defined very narrowly. So we got somewhere, but very narrowly, almost suggesting the old quid pro quo. But we've moved on. So there are many, many cases. I mean, the cultural slangs would be different. There's an English case where they call somebody a big tits. Well, first, that's not a big thing. You know, West Indian people not into tits, you know, or fat cow. We don't really understand. But for us, we understand mule, calling someone a mule. So it's a cultural context. So these are ideas as to in terms of how we could frame this notion of a hostile working environment based on sex. So it's not only about sexual words, sexual conduct. That's the most popular thing that happens, but it's not only that. If we really ground it within the context of unequal power relations, gender discrimination, all of that. There, I can go even further. If you were every day telling a woman women are not bright enough or strong enough to be leaders every day at the workplace, is that gender discrimination? Is that a form of harassment? You see where we can go with it. But some legislation can, as Barbados has done, limit it to the sexual aspects. But many of us understand, and many countries know, including the UK legislation, that it's broader than that. So need not be sexual or sexy. As to existing law, very little in the Caribbean. Belize has had law for a very long time. And even for your cases, we have also, well, Grenada has sexual harassment as well, St. Lucia has in the labor, in their labor laws, but we have also some anti-discrimination laws. Again, not many. Guyana, St. Lucia, Grenada, again. Only very few countries even have broad anti-discrimination laws. So we're not in a very strong place, unfortunately. So even if we say, let's go under the anti-discrimination norms, we're kind of weak. CARICOM has had a draft sexual harassment law for many, many, many years. I think it's outdated, it was the old form. Then years ago in 1992, when I did the CARICOM harmonization of labor law report, we had that, where there was a model. Now I see IMPACT as another model. I think it's time for us to move away from the drafts and the models and just create the legislation. And I think in the private sector has overtaken us in some ways. Many firms actually have their own code, their code of conduct, and it's in their company handbooks, which is fine, and usually they do talk about the hostile working environment, and some of them are very advanced. Part of that has to do with the fact that our trading partners, thankfully, would sometimes not give us aid or trade with us if we don't have enlightened human rights policies at work. So you're kind of forced, but that doesn't matter how it got here. At the university, we have had one, and we recently, last year, upgraded it. So sexual harassment is now a form of misconduct and leads to disciplinary and so on. So we are hopefully embarking on new laws against sexual harassment, and we need to understand the realistic expectations under those laws and what are the options that we need. Now, the concept of fairness in industrial relations environment, which is a very important one, has to be brought into that whole idea. What is fair? What is reasonable? Much of what we will do with the law, or what we need to do with the law, is really, I would say, preventative. Something like when you have laws for seatbelts or drunk driving. So having a law, the rationale for the law, is not just to punish people. Yes, we want to punish Mr. Brown and others, but it's also to change the culture. We want to be able to try to change the culture. Yeah, there's a catalyst reform. Start thinking about what we really need and so on. So educational function. However, as we await this great legislative change, there are other routes to addressing sexual harassment, certainly in the workplace. Perhaps not so easy outside of the workplace, but there are several legal routes to addressing sexual harassment today. And unfortunately, we don't take them. I just know about two cases in sexual harassment region, two real cases, one good, one bad. The most important route is through unfair dismissal legislation law. Now, 10 years ago, when we talked about this, we had very few unfair dismissal laws. Today, almost every country, except Jamaica, God bless you, and Trinidad, to some extent, the only two countries that don't have specific unfair dismissal legislation. Thankfully, in Jamaica, since I'm in Jamaica, I have to say something good about Jamaica. Thankfully, your Chief Justice Rattray, in a case called Village Resorts, created a law on his own, more or less, which was upheld by the Privy Council, that so you have some sort of norm of unfair dismissal, or what you call unreasonable dismissal in your law. Trinidad, similarly, the industrial court, without having any legislation, they located unfairness in that idea, what is an unfair industrial relations practice. And they went so far as sexual harassment, as we will see. So everybody has some way of using the notion of what is an unfair dismissal to address sexual harassment. Usually, surprise, surprise, it comes about where the so-called harasser is the one saying, as Mr. Brown said, hello, I think I'm under attack. You know what he said? Very realistic. So the fella, usually is a fella, not always, and he says, you know, they say, oh, you're harassing, exposing to me. In the case of the Trinidad, Republic Bank, he said, well, no, I treat her like a sister. That's what I do, you know, pinch her bottom and things. He said, that's what I do, my sister. You know, it's nothing. What is that? What are you attacking me for? In the two cases that we know of, the Baiko case from Barbados and Trinidad, case of Republic Bank, the person was dismissed. So the question was, were they unfairly dismissed? You see, so they're using the law to protect the harasser, right? In the Baiko case, I suspect, Professor Newton, you don't want to hear about this, right? Because Barbados, I think we hang our heads in shame. At this point, I'm treating myself as a Barbadian, having lived there so long. When the magistrate, a woman, said, that was mere ungentlemanly conduct. Yes? It's an old case, so we could forgive Barbados. But it was quite outrageous. He was peeping at them when they changed their clothes. He talked about their nooksies. Until I read that case, I had no idea what a nooksie was. But I still am not too sure, right? But in any event, you know, and the same pinching of bottom, that seems to be a common thread. Yeah? But he got away scot-free. But in the Republic Bank case, the Trinidad Industrial Court said no, looked at the ILO, I don't know if anybody from ILO is here today, and said, in this day and age, and I was in the 90s, we have to address sexual harassment. So we had nothing to go on in law, but they were able to look at it as an unfair industrial relation. So unfair dismissal norm is very powerful. In order to use it, of course, we have to accept, and society has to accept, that sexual harassment, gender discrimination, is indeed something we disapprove of, no? So there has to be growth, there has to be understanding by those who apply it. So that's the important thing, because what is reasonable is what we look at in unfair dismissal, and that is, in a way, a subjective thing. Now, for the victim, quote-unquote, we can look at constructive dismissal, which is, of course, an aspect of unfair dismissal as well. We didn't get the name of the victim in the skit. But you heard when they were saying, the manager said, I don't want to lose another valuable employee. So there is a sense of productivity here, very important, by the way. Many people leave, women leave, and they may never say why they leave, and you're losing good people. But constructive dismissal, if you leave and you have proper and fair dismissal norms which recognize discrimination, you can get damages, or you can be reinstated if that is what you want. But ultimately, there has to be a basis to evaluate the dismissals, and you have to accept and understand the phenomenon, what you're really dealing with. But I would still say it is preferable to have specific laws to address it, because it's not always easy that general labor law, industrial relations law, and so on will really inform these decisions, and we may not have that understanding, especially those of us, although we've put in place this anti-discrimination law and so on, many of us have never used the law. Eh? It's just there in the statute books. We have no, some of us don't even know it's there. I've heard politicians saying, we need to have a law on gender equality. I'm thinking, but you already have a law. They don't even know they have it. And that is true. I'm not going to say which country, all right? Okay, so this is a true thing. We have to have public education, if you really understand. So dismissal law is limited also because it is not in every case that somebody will be dismissed. So we can't just look to dismissal law, although there's a powerful notion. We have some help in tort, you know, causing harm to others, but that's a very tortuous road. Forgive the pun, and we really don't need to go there. Perhaps the next useful one would be the idea of implied terms having a healthy and safe working environment. That is one, or even mutual trust and confidence in the workplace. That all of us have that. That comes from the common law and is part of the employment contract, a fundamental term, though implied. You don't have to write it down. It's there. And if you do certain things, employer, if your conduct breaches trust, mutual trust, that is something that we can pursue. And if the employer doesn't, in fact, provide a safe working environment, that is also something that has legal liability in employment law. And today, unlike long ago, we accept that health and safety is not only about your physical health and safety. So psychological stress, all these things. So sexual harassment is that's a useful thing to think of for all of those of you now who want to rush out and sort of sue somebody. You have that right away while the parliament creates a new law. So that's important. Important stopgaps. Now let's look a little bit at the limits of sexual harassment law. And I think that's where we are now, kind of thinking, is everything sexual harassment? I know some of y'all don't want to say it, but I will say it. Everything is not sexual harassment, all right? So we need to change the culture of gender equality and sexual violence, but there is a line to be drawn. We know, I personally believe, that we're witnessing what might be the extreme end, because you know all the unleashed frustration coming out, but then we have to find the balance, in terms of legal liability. Bear in mind, in some countries, and St. Lucia is notable in the Commonwealth Caribbean, simply because they have a hybrid mixed legal tradition, they have a code. So under their code, sexual harassment is also a criminal offense. Yeah, that is not normally the case in most countries. So they have it both ways. They have it the labor code and also the code. So if you're talking about criminal liability, one, you know, we're talking about serious jail time and so on. So in the same Republic Bank case in Trinidad and Tobago a few years ago, I think that's a helpful case because the court was trying to find that balance. So the fellas are told, he said that he treated him like that was his sister, you know, he wasn't doing any old, there was no big thing. So the court said, well, and other courts have said similar things. It's not a civility code. This is a UK court saying this. Meaning it's not that, you know, what you would call politically correct. So you can't even say you're looking nice today. Or like me, I like to sweet talk to the fellas, hey, you're looking real nice today. Or how come that shirt, you know, you don't want to do that. That should not be sexual harassment. I think most of us will agree. A code of civility, that's what it's not. In that Republic Bank case, the judge talked about Pekong. You all know Pekong? Oh gosh, the Caribbean people are supposed to know that at least. Y'all don't know your Caribbean slang? How come we know the Jamaican slangs? So Pekong is light bantering. Y'all know Mama Guy? Oh, Lord. Anyway, Pekong is when, you know, you're a little jokey, light banter is what it would be. And that is, you know, Trinidadians like to do that. They like to talk, old talk, banter. They said it's not that. That's not what they're trying to legislate against. So we are Caribbean people. We should be allowed to have a, so, you know, we don't want to straitjacket ourselves. At the same time, the law should be sensitive and understanding enough to be able to identify those instances where there is harm, where there's injury, and you may not always know, yeah? Because people tend to suffer in silence. A long time that's going on as a case. So there's that balance in terms of what we're looking at, what it is not. And also some of the cases acknowledged, because we have questions that come up as to suppose, you know, the so-called victim seems to have gone along with it. You know, they engage, maybe engage sometimes with the banter and so. And when you look at all of the facts and circumstances, the courts have said, especially the more recent courts, because we are more understanding of the phenomenon, saying that in itself doesn't mean that it wasn't unwelcome. We may have cases where persons entered into a sexual relationship with the boss, and it was talked about the organic idea of power. Did you have a choice? You know, does it mean because you acquiesced that it's not unwanted? So those are really important questions. The other point that I thought was important to flag in our understanding, and also in terms of perhaps some of the limits, the notion of is in whose eyes and how do we assess it? So in law, we talk about the subjective test or the subjective reality and the objective test. So sexual harassment, when it comes before the courts, has to meet both tests, which is unusual, eh? Usually it's one, like subjective test. What the man in the cup and bus, or the man in Ligony, or Halfway Tree in Jamaica, what that man or woman thinks is reasonable. That's what we call an objective test. Now, we all think, you know, but when we start talking about subjectivity, I have to feel that way. So it's unusual to have two. So the victim, let's call the person a victim, although that is not a language that we kind of like too much, must believe or perceive herself to be harassed or himself. So it's unwelcome. I feel offended. Even if you don't feel offended, I feel offended. But then the court must then have an objective assessment. So it's sort of a two-pronged thing. I think it's easier to understand the other way around, that even if it seems outrageously offensive, if the victim did not feel offended, it's not sexual harassment. I think it's easier that way around than trying to look at it. So I'm just giving you a little title, one little case here, Driscoll, a case from the UK. The ultimate judgment, sexual discrimination or no, as I told you, as part of sexual discrimination, reflects an objective assessment by the tribunal of all of the facts. That said, among the factors to be considered are the applicant's subjective perception of that which is the subject of the complaint. Yeah? And clearly, after you discussed this yesterday, what is objective is also depending on the broad understanding of the society of these gender discrimination issues. They cannot be divorced. So really, the education thing is really important. I also wonder about our very pluralistic societies. Some religious groups may, certain behaviors may be different for others, etc., and so on. So it's really quite a complex test. Another limitation or question we should ask: to what extent should third parties be liable? Now, this was an excellent manager in our skit. That is not the typical scenario. And most of us in our lives, most of us who are women, including me, have experienced that. Where there's somebody try a thing, supervisor, you go to the boss. I know in my first little job, playing fast in Trinidad, going to work for the holidays, and the fella, he did it to everybody else, so he tried me. Of course, I didn't need a job because I was going UWE next year. But he didn't know that. So I, you know, so he got away with it. And I went and I told the engineer, and he said, don't worry about that. That's what he told me. Don't worry, you know. That is typical, isn't it? Yes. That is typical. Well, of course, having a mother that I had, a Grenadian mother, typical West Indian mother, she told me, go and tape him. So I taped him. And I told the whole office, and he never spoke to me again until I left, but I was all right. He was named and shamed. But most people in that office, as with many offices, have no choice, so vulnerability. But to what extent should that manager, should that person have liability, or should the firm and so on have liability? And the simple point is, and it's not a simple point, but the fact is, yes, there is liability. So if it happens in the course of employment, managers, the employers, the state, as the case may be, they have liability. There are all kinds of tests as to where the lines are drawn in the course of employment, what that means, etc. But for me, the most important point there is that every single enterprise or state or place has to now be proactive and preventative to ensure that you don't get yourself. And that's where we should be going. Also the question as to whether, and that's an important question in constructing a law, whether third parties have duties to report. And that was something we considered, Pat, you remember, I don't know if you would have this thing about if the victim is afraid to go forward, makes a complaint, what happens? Is that the end of it? At the university, we said no. We have now determined that you could have what we call an ex proprio motu. You could, on behalf of other people, or without naming, you could say, go forward with a complaint. But those are important questions. The labor commissioner, as the case may be, the dean, the principal, so forth and so forth. So vicarious liability, that's when the liability moves from the other person to the manager and so on. That's important. And all of these other questions that crop up. As I said, what we are trying to do is create a new culture. I think a very important one, and one that I was, again, disappointed in the new Barbados Act, is to whom is the law addressed, if you're talking about the workplace? Because our employment laws generally speak to only employees, under employments of services or contracts of services, and there are a whole host of other people who work who are not considered employees. So we need to ensure that the law is broad enough, independent contractors, those who come, you know, into contact, that is something that we need to look at if we are really serious about it. And are we going to address sexual harassment outside of the workplace? I see Velma, your impact model. I mean, I have some problems with that, but I see it's attempts to go beyond the workplace, which is good. We have the schools and universities are obvious examples and obvious imbalances and demarcations of power, the lecturer, the student, etc. What about public spaces? Again, every West Indian child can remember the humiliation, woman child at any rate, walking down the streets and feeling humiliated, all the catcalls, especially if you live in Trinidad. The leggings movement in Trinidad, in the region, I think sort of captured that whole point. And now there's a big discussion in Trinidad about carnival. Did you hear about that? Whether you can whine on somebody. So public spaces, you know, where do we go? Do we want to go as far as that? Can we even enforce it? And the two last points I want to make is, one, I think the more I think about discrimination and all these issues, I think we have to consider issues of what we call intersectionality. And that is that there are issues of race and class that must be unpacked when we speak of these issues. It's not only about gender and how that gets translated into symptoms of equality. So we have the Hollywood version of sexual harassment, and I'm not trivializing it, it's real. But I think there are different degrees of vulnerability, and certainly in the Caribbean, certain types of races be more vulnerable to sexual harassment, certain income brackets. So this intersectionality, looking at all of that, if you consider, for instance, indigenous women in Guyana, historically, very vulnerable to sexual harassment, assault, and all of those things. Also consider our sex tourism industries. I'm not even going to go into that because you know exactly where I'm going. So, and who are Afro-Caribbean women and so on? Do we need to look at it from those planes as well? Our discrimination law tends to be rigidly separated. And finally, do we need specialized tribunals? that are more sensitive and trained, and how do we look at the burden of proof, because it's very difficult to prove sexual harassment. Not everybody's going to tape as I did, and often what we do is we reverse the burden of proof. So lots of you to chew on. Thank you so much.